Brihadvrata takes a vow to remain a brahmachari perpetually. The Brihadvrata brahmachari does not return from the place of the spiritual master. He stays there, and later he directly takes sannyas. Because Nabhaga did not return from the place of his spiritual master, his brothers thought that he had taken Brihadvrata brahmacharya. Therefore, they did not preserve his share, and when he returned, they gave him their father as his share. Om jnanati mirandasya jnananjana shalakaya chakshurun militam yena tasmai shri guruve namaha. Nabhago navagapatyam yantatam bratara kavim yavishtam vyapachan dhyam brahmacharinam agatam. So the context we're reading here, this canto, at least the beginning of it, well, the whole thing, it actually runs through the descendants of Vaivaswata Manu, his dynasty. So we're hearing about different sons of Vaivaswata Manu. He was also called Shradadev Manu. We're hearing about those one after the other here, and different stories about them or their descendants. So here we're hearing about the son named Maharaj Nabhaga. So he was one of the sons, and his son was Nabhaga. And this story, now we're hearing right now, this is the beginning of that story of Nabhaga, something interesting about him. So the story is that he had brothers, and apparently they went to the Gurukul too, but they also, when they were done with the Gurukul, they were done. They came home from the Gurukul, but he was the youngest. Nabhaga was the youngest. He went to the Gurukul, and they waited and waited and waited, and he didn't come back. So they thought, well, I guess he's going to be a Naishika Brahmachari. I guess he's not coming back. Apparently they didn't have any communication, no email or anything. So they didn't exactly know what was going on. So they just assumed. And it seems as if they had some not exactly pure motives. They said, well, he's not coming back. Let's divide up our father's property. Now, the interesting thing here is the father was still alive. But they said, well, why wait till he's dead? Let's divide everything up now. So they divided everything up among the... Does it say that there were four of them? Somehow I had this idea that there were four of them, however many there were. The other brothers divided everything up among themselves. Then all of a sudden, Nabhaga shows up at the door. Hey, where's my part? He wanted his inheritance too. Daya. Daya Bhak, the inheritance. So he wanted to know where his was. And they said, oh, you can have dad. We've taken everything else. The only thing left is dad himself. So you can have him. So as the story goes on, then he goes and sees dad. Apparently they weren't living in the same place. And dad says, they're a bunch of cheaters and rascals. Don't listen to what they say. In any case, I'll tell you what to do. You have to make a livelihood. You're not going to remain as a brahmachari. So I'll tell you what to do. You go to this sacrifice where the Angira, I think it said here. Anyway, one dynasty. I think it's the descendants of Angira, if I remember correctly. Anyway, one dynasty, they're performing sacrifices there. And every day when they get, every time they do the sacrifice, they get to the sixth day, they kind of get confused about things, and they tend to make mistakes. So if you go there and you describe these two Vedic mantras, that'll take care of things for them. And then you'll end up getting all their money, all the riches that were given in charity, in the sacrifice, that are part of the sacrifice, you'll get all of that. So he did what his father told him to do, and he goes there. We'll see this upcoming verses. So he goes there and he does that. I'm a little vague on what it means by describing Vedic mantras. But anyway, the solution was to describe two Vedic mantras. And when he did that, then the sacrifice went on well. And at the end of the sacrifice, there was some kind of like ceremony, and all the demigods were giving all of their wealth they had obtained as a result of the sacrifice. They were going to give it all to Nabhaga because he made sure things went properly. But then some other person shows up who is apparently Lord Shiva in disguise, And he says, actually, this doesn't belong to you. It belongs to Lord Shiva. Because, and he made some reference to how the sacrifice is conducted. And when he spoke this to Nabhaga and his father, they both said, yes, actually, you're right. This all goes to Lord Shiva. And since you're Lord Shiva, here, you take it all. And then Lord Shiva says, oh, you're a very nice devotee. You keep it. And so he gave everything, all the wealth back to him, and he took off. So this is the story of Nabhaga. And he's the father of Maharaj Ambarish. So we see often how there are nice families involved in these pastimes. These great devotees, often they come. Sometimes, of course, we have Prahlad Maharaj as an exception. In fact, that's one amazing thing about Prahlad Maharaj. He's an exception because he came from a demoniac family. But generally we see that these great devotees, they come from good families. They have culture. They have a spiritual religious heritage. When we read about Maharaj Ambarish, what his character was like is just astounding. He was a pure devotee. And he ruled the whole world. But this was his father, the story of his father. Sometimes we think, boy, what would it be like if you actually had a pure devotee who had power, real power and influence, and ruled the whole world? What would that be like? Well, we have examples in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And Maharaj Ambarish is one of those. And what we hear about Maharaj Ambarish is that the people were devotees because he was a devotee. So he was leading everyone. And they were all devotees, all the citizens of the state or the world. He was a world emperor of the world. So they were devotees of the Lord, at least generally, the people in general, because he was leading them that way. Often when we hear about the Vedic culture, we get that there seems to be a lot of impersonalism or emphasis on Brahman realization. Or sometimes Prabhupada would even use the word Mayavadi. Even highly posted personalities in the universe, Prabhupada sometimes calls them Mayavadis. He sometimes says Mayavadis are Brahmavadis. So there's a certain disdain, we might say. Maybe that's too strong a word. But for Brahmavadis, that's not enough for us. The real Brahmavadi is Brahma. Brahma means the supreme absolute truth, the supreme personality of Godhead. Interestingly, in the story of Ambarish Maharaj, it's mentioned there, of course, Durvasa Muni, the story, Durvasa Muni shows up when Ambarish Maharaj is about to break his one-year Ekadasi and Dwadashi Vrata. So Durvasa Muni, he's a great sage. And so when he arrives there, Ambarish Maharaj has to welcome him. But Durvasa Muni says, well, let me take a bath first before I eat. So he goes and he bathes in Yamuna. I was kind of reminded of this. I had forgotten this. I just read through the chapter. Ambarish Maharaj was performing his austerities in Madhuban in Vrindavan. For 1 year, he was performing this Ekadasi and Dwadasi Vrata. So when Durvasa Muni went to take his bath, he went to take his bath in Yamuna. So you'd think when he came back, he'd be a nice guy. He just took his bath in Yamuna, thinking, well, he'd be purified. But it's interesting because in the verse it says that he went there and he was performing his midday regulative activities, whatever they were. So it says there that brihat dhyana. So brihat means great, but it also means Brahman. These two words are connected. The word Brahman comes from brihat, means the greatest thing. So brihat dhyana, you could say, well, he was meditating on Krishna. In some places, if this were a devotee meditating, Prabhupada would probably say he was meditating on Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But here, Prabhupada translates it, he was meditating on the impersonal Brahma Jyoti. So this was what Durvasa Muni was doing. He's in Yamuna River in Krishna's place, and he's meditating on the impersonal Brahma Jyoti. So when he comes out of the water, he's not in Krishna consciousness. Somehow or other, apparently his meditation is even on the Brahma Jyoti is not quite working very well. So he comes out and he's very offensive, of course. He's very offensive to Durvasa Muni, Ambarish Maharaj. And of course Ambarish, then he gets angry and he pulls out his hair and he creates this demon. And then Sudarshan Chakra appears to protect Ambarish Maharaj. So another thing I picked up as I was looking through the chapter, which I had forgotten, was that it describes how Ambarish Maharaj became perfect in his Krishna consciousness. And then Krishna rewarded him by saying, now you will have my Sudarshan Chakra as your protector. So this was a previous arrangement, actually, that Sudarshan was sort of on standby. If anything happened to Ambarish Maharaj, Sudarshan was there. So as soon as Durvasa Muni created his demon, then Sudarshan appeared and just, there goes the demon. He was finished. And then Sudarshan, of course, started chasing him all over the place. Finally up to Lord Narayan himself. And Lord Narayan said, I can't forgive you. You have to get forgiveness from Ambarish Maharaj. So this is Ambarish Maharaj's story. And his father is Nabhaga, whom we're hearing about here. The story starts, as this verse, the first verse of the chapter, talking about Brahmacharya, because he was going to the... Nabhaga was away as a brahmachari in the ashram of the spiritual master. Now this was the, as Prabhupada would often point out, the three higher classes would send their children to the Gurukul, the place of the spiritual master. They would be trained in brahmacharya. Brahmacharya is... the word itself, again, Brahma, we have the word Brahma again, Brahmavadi, Brahmacharya. Brahmacharya means one who moves in Brahman. Just like Krishna's Yamuna Tira Vanachari. He moves on the bank of the Yamuna River. So the Brahmachari moves in Brahman. And Brahma also means, of course, the Vedic scriptures. We'll often see that when referring to the Vedas, the word Brahma is used. So Brahmachari also means that the primary activity of the brahmachari is to study the Vedic scriptures. Actually, to study everything. We hear how Krishna and Balaram, when they went to the Gurukul, they studied everything. The 64 arts. All kinds of things. In fact, when you read that list, some of it you think, boy, this is really pretty strange stuff. Some of the things they learned. How to make different kinds of things, handicrafts and all kinds of things. Some kinds of mental games and mathematics, all kinds of things. So this goes on. It's a school. The early life is meant for education. Now, of course, in the traditional school, the Gurukul was the school. So in the traditional school, spiritual training was primary. And celibacy, of course, an emphasis on celibate life. And those who could remain celibate would remain celibate. So the brothers of this Nabhaga, they thought, well, he's just not going to get married. He's just going to take sannyas. He's been away for a long time. Maybe he was old by that time, and they figured, well, gee, he's too old to be still a brahmachari. He's probably going to stay there, take sannyas. So the brahmachari ashram is for this. It's for really for establishing the foundation for one's life. I was going to read in the... where we get specific instruction about brahmacharya is in the 7th canto, where Narada Muni is instructing Yudhishthir Maharaj, and he gives instructions for the different ashrams. This is the 12th chapter of the 7th canto. The title of it is The Perfect Society for Spiritual Classes. So this begins with a description of and instructions about brahmacharya life. The first is a most famous of these verses. Srinarada Uvacha, Brahmachari Guru Kule, Vasandanto Guru Hitam, Acharan Dasavan Nicho, Gurau Sudrida Saurida. Narada Muni said, a student should practice completely controlling his senses. He should be submissive and should have an attitude of firm friendship for the spiritual master. With a great vow, the brahmachari should live in the Gurukul only for the benefit of the guru. So this is really ashram life. Many of us had experience coming to Krishna consciousness, living in the ashram in the early days of our lives. Very controlled, regulated atmosphere, strict separation of the sexes, quite different from family life. I was thinking it's a little ironic. I just returned from a trip, and I'm doing a verse on brahmachari life. And I just took a trip with my wife and our 22-month-old granddaughter to visit her family. So I was completely absorbed in Grihastha consciousness, you can say. Now I'm coming back to give a class on Brahmacharya. So in any case, so this is we were trained, many of us were trained, we know what it was like in the early days of, especially of us from old timers, living in the ashram. And I remember when I was in San Francisco, I joined in the San Francisco temple, we all slept on the floor. And I think around 3:30, the temple president would come in with this huge bell. It was like the one that we ring outside the door here. So I had an alarm clock, and I always made sure I woke up at least five minutes before the bell ringer came through. Practically knock your brains out with that bell. It was so loud. So this was, but we were taught discipline, of course, and austerity. This was impressed upon us. This is Brahmacharya life, austerity. Prabhupada used to say that when children are trained in that atmosphere, they get accustomed to it, and it actually becomes, it's not a difficult thing if you're trained in the beginning of your life. So the Gurukul was set up for that because, as Rishabhdev teaches, human life is actually meant for austerity. Tapo divyam putraka yena sattvam shujyed brahma sokyam tanantam. If you want to get unlimited pleasure, everlasting pleasure, which is the craving of the soul, the natural state of the soul, then you can't chase after pleasure or happiness. This is actually the problem, is in this world, these two things are considered synonymous, pleasure and happiness. But pleasure and happiness, sensual pleasure, does not equal happiness. Happiness is something else. So if you want happiness, then you have to restrict your pursuit of pleasure in this world. Pleasure means what the senses get. Satisfaction, sense gratification, we call it. Rishabhdev says the pigs are getting that same kind of pleasure. So that's not happiness. But if you want happiness, real happiness, then tapo divyam, you have to perform transcendental austerities. Then you get ananta sukh, you get unlimited pleasure in Krishna consciousness. So in the Gurukul, the brahmachari, the student, is trained in austerity, living very simply, going out and begging. This may be the greatest austerity, to beg from others. It's very humbling, humiliating experience. Tests one's many qualities. Vaishnava qualities are tested when one has to speak to others and try to engage them in Krishna consciousness. So this is teaches humility, and some of the characteristics of the brahmachari life are mentioned here. Completely submissive, completely controlling the senses, having attitude of firm friendship for the spiritual master. Krishna tells us in Bhagavad Gita that he's Suridam Sarvadehinam. He's the friend of all living entities. So the spiritual master is a representative of Krishna. He's also the dearmost friend because he's representing Krishna. And he's also the dearest friend because who is the friend? The friend is the person who acts for your benefit, who really has your benefit in mind, doesn't want to exploit you in any way. This is practically inconceivable in the material world. There's always something that we want to get from the other person. Our relationships are based on these things. That's what brings people together. Some kind of mutual benefit they can get. But the relationship with the spiritual master, the benefit has nothing to do with this world. It has to do with the supreme benefit, Shreya. Shreya Uttamam. It is said that one should go to the spiritual master when one wants Shreya Uttamam, the highest benefit, the highest good. When one is done with chasing after Preya, the temporary goals, then one goes to the spiritual master. No, I'm tired of pursuing these temporary things that don't bring satisfaction. I want the ultimate benefit. So the spiritual master is the greatest friend because that's what he's giving. He's not giving temporary things. Sometimes Prabhupada would be approached by people. They want him to make some magic, just like there are certain yogis, they can produce something out of thin air. So Prabhupada wasn't interested in that. Producing wealth, producing ordinary things. That's not what he was giving. Actually, there's one interesting letter It was Rupanuga Prabhu wrote to Prabhupada one time. And he asked him, he said, Prabhupada, was it true that yogis, they used to be able to make gold? There's some process, alchemy? Of course, Prabhupada explained the process one time. He said they would drink mercury and then urinate on something, some other metal, and become gold. That was the process of creating gold from some other metal. So Rupanuga was asked, Prabhupada, maybe if we learned how to do this, we'd get a lot of money, and that would be good for spreading Krishna consciousness. So Prabhupada's response was, the problem is, as soon as we get a lot of money, we fall into Maya. That's our tendency. That's what he said. Because sometimes we think, too, why doesn't Krishna just send us everything? Well, because we can't handle it. That's the problem. We'll be carried away by that. Well, so Prabhupada never encouraged us to try to figure out how to create gold by drinking mercury. He also said, of course, if you drink mercury, you'll die. Because mercury is highly poisonous. So only a yogi can perfect that method. Not just anybody off the street is going to learn how to do that. So in any case, so the spiritual master is not offering gold, material things. The spiritual master is offering the greatest thing. And that makes the spiritual master the greatest friend. So the disciple has to feel that way always, has to have that strong feeling of connection with the spiritual master. This is my friend. Not buddy friend, but well-wisher friend, Sudip. So let me just read a little more here, some of the other verses about Brahmacharya. Of course, this is written thousands of years ago, so the context was drastically different from the way things are today, but we can get an idea at least of the principles that were followed and some of the things that went on to support those principles. At both junctions of day and night, namely in the early morning and in the evening, he should be fully absorbed in thoughts of the spiritual master, fire, the sun god, and Lord Vishnu, and by chanting the Gayatri Mantra, he should worship them. So as I understand it, traditionally the Gayatri Mantra was given at the beginning, or fairly early in the Brahmachari training for the disciples, because they had to chant the Gayatri Mantra, perform Vedic sacrifices, and so on. So they were given, they became Dvija, twice born, when they entered the Gurukul, so they could perform these different Brahminical, especially the Brahmins, Brahmins in the Gurukul would perform these duties. Being called by the spiritual master, the student should study the Vedic mantras regularly. Every day before beginning his studies and at the end of his studies, the disciple should respectfully offer obeisances unto the spiritual master. We find often in the previous verse and also in this one, at both junctions of day and night, early morning and in the evening, and then again here, beginning of the day and the end of the day. So Prabhupada had this same principle in our day of Krishna consciousness, that you especially begin with a strong spiritual foundation and you end on a strong spiritual note. And then throughout the day, you also try to perform Krishna conscious activities. So then carrying pure kusha grass in his hand, the brahmachari should dress regularly with a belt of straw and with deerskin garments. He should wear matted hair, carry a rod and water pot, and be decorated with a sacred thread as recommended in the shastras. And we were just reading not too long ago the story of Vamanadev. So we have his painting also. So this is what he looked like. He was given these different articles of clothing and paraphernalia by different higher entities. So this is how the brahmachari would dress traditionally. Matted hair, belt of straw, deerskin garments, carry a water pot, so on. The brahmachari should go out morning and evening to collect alms, and he should offer all that he collects to the spiritual master. He should eat only if offered to take food by the spiritual master. Otherwise, if the spiritual master does not give this order, he may sometimes have to fast. So this shows how the brahmachari is not independent in any way. He's completely dependent on the order of the spiritual master. He does only what he is told. Very strict training. And he collects things for the ashram, going door to door. Especially the ladies of the house would give something to the young brahmachari coming to the door to collect for the Gurukul ashram. They just give a little something, some grain or some chapati flour, some vegetables, some little thing. The brahmacharis would go out to collect those things to support the ashram and the spiritual master. A brahmachari should be quite well behaved and gentle, and should not eat or collect more than necessary. We can see how these principles, this is right out of Rupa Goswami's Upadeshamrita, should not eat or collect more than necessary, eating more than necessary. Atyahara prayasascha. So these are the first two of the six things that destroy devotional service. So this is practiced in the Gurukul. You modify your senses. You don't overdo it. You don't eat fully. You eat frugally and collect frugally. In fact, everything that the brahmacharya collects is given to the spiritual master, so he doesn't really have anything. He must always be active and expert, fully believing in the instructions of the spiritual master and the shastra. Fully controlling his senses, he should associate only as much as necessary with women or those controlled by women. So this, of course, brahmachari, or the strict disassociation between men and women, is especially there in not only brahmachari life, but in three ashrams, in vanaprastha, especially the later stages of vanaprastha, and sannyas also. It's only the grihastha who has some freedom to associate with the opposite sex. So especially the brahmachari is, as Prabhupada says here, a brahmachari should be very careful in associating with men who are attached to women. What to speak of women, even men who are attached to women. So the next verse, text 7. A brahmachari, or one who has not accepted the grihastha ashram, must rigidly avoid talking with women or about women, for the senses are so powerful that they may agitate even the mind of a sannyasi, a member of the renounced order of life. So we see how this brahmachari, the celibacy aspect, is quite strong and emphasized in several verses here. If the wife of the spiritual master is young, a young brahmachari should not allow her to care for his hair, massage his body with oil, or bathe him with affection like a mother. So we can see here we get a kind of a picture of the traditional Vedic Gurukul ashram. It's a family situation. There's the brahmana and his wife, and they have children, young boys living in the ashram, and they're taking care of them but giving them spiritual instruction. So sometimes the mother, the wife, may be quite elderly or much older than the young brahmachari. So in that case, maybe there's not so much danger of attraction. But if the wife is young, there has to be more care taken. But in any case, the teacher, the husband, he's like a father to the boys. So the mother, they're living in kind of a family situation. So the wife of the brahmani, she's also a teacher, and she's a mother. She's acting as a mother also in this situation. And then this famous verse, Nanvagni pramada nama grita kumba samapuman sutamapi rahuja hyad anyada yavarartakrit. Woman is compared to fire and man is compared to a butter pot. So if you ever wonder where this came from, this is the context of it. It's in the context of Narada Muni talking about brahmachari life. Therefore, a man should avoid associating even with his own daughter in a secluded place. Similarly, he should always avoid association with other women. One should associate with women only for important business and not otherwise. And this is, I'll just read this one more verse, which I always thought was quite interesting. As long as a living entity is not completely self-realized, as long as he is not independent of the misconception of identifying with his body, which is nothing but a reflection of the original body and senses, he cannot be relieved of the conception of duality, which is epitomized by the duality between man and woman. Thus, there is every chance that he will fall down because his intelligence is bewildered. So this is quite a strong cautionary note here. It says that if you're not self-realized, then you're going to think, this is a man, this is a woman. And as long as you're still in that consciousness, then there's danger of fall down, sexual fall down. So these are very strong words from Narada Muni. Of course, Narada Muni in many places gives very strong instructions. He's a brahmachari himself, Naishtika brahmachari, travels all over the universe. He tends to preach this side of things, strict renunciation and so on. we see in the story of what's his name, with all the daughters, Daksha. So Daksha and his sons. So Daksha was creating sons who were supposed to populate the universe, and Narada kept turning them into sannyasis. So Daksha didn't like that very much, because Daksha had another point of view. And when you read it, you'll say, well, this doesn't sound so bad. Daksha said, well, let them take sannyas when they're supposed to take sannyas. Let them go through the ordinary course of life, get married, have children, advance in spiritual life, and then they can take sannyas at the end of life. But Narada Muni said, no, why should they waste their time? Of course, he saw something in them. He said, they're already spiritually advanced personalities. Why should they go through all that? So that's the difference. If you can do it, remain brahmachari, take sannyas, that's very good. But that's the rare person who can do that. But Narada Muni is always looking for that rare soul, always trying to encourage it. And in encouraging it in those who can rise to that level of realization, then he's also encouraging all of us to aspire for that and to understand. The Prabhupada himself also said it many times, the best thing, and we see it in the lives of acharyas, not all of them, but many of them, they say, why should I get involved in this material world at all? We see very extreme, just like Bharat Maharaj. And we were just reading about someone recently, I forgot the name, who did the same thing. He just said, why should I don't want to get absorbed in material life because it's so dangerous. This material world is just an illusion. Why should I have any connection with it? Let me just forget it and become a sannyasi. Just give it all up. So there are those who do that. Now, of course, we live in different times. We also live in the era of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and even you might say under the aura of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Still, his influence is there, pervades the Krishna consciousness movement because of the fidelity of our parampara. So we, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had many grihastha disciples. That although there's an interesting verse in the, I think it's Chaitanya Charitamrita, where it says that Lord Chaitanya very much liked renunciation in his disciples, all of his disciples. And when he would see that renunciation, it would please him very much. So even though he had many grihastha disciples, they were, of course, very spiritually elevated personalities. Sometimes their examples are a little hard to understand. What they point out, what they show, is that these are nitya siddhas, just like Ramananda Rai, what he was doing, massaging the bodies of women dancers. So obviously that's not an ordinary thing. Even if you're an advanced grihastha, you don't do that. But he could do it because of his exalted position. But in general, the example that we get from Lord Chaitanya's pastimes, which is more current for us, is that one can live a perfectly Krishna conscious life in the grihastha ashram because his followers did it. Lord Chaitanya came to teach by example how to become a devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, how to be a devotee of Krishna. So naturally his followers are also part of that instruction. His whole lila, which includes his associates, is part of that instruction, how to live a Krishna-conscious life in the modern age, you might say. 500 years ago is much more modern than 5,000 years ago. So we have grihasthas living brahmacharya grihastha life. Sometimes this word is used, brahmachari grihasthas. It means grihasthas, as opposed to grihamedis, who follow principles in associating with the opposite sex, the husband with the wife, or the wife with the husband. So that's the way we are trained. There's a brahmacharya element, you might say, that runs through all the ashrams in the Krishna consciousness movement, because it's so important, it's such an important principle. And many principles, as we're reading about here. It's not only the celibacy aspect that's important, but these other things, these other foundations of spiritual life, foundational principles of spiritual life that are imbibed in the brahmachari ashram, they're important through all the ashrams. They're important for anyone who's practicing spiritual life. So especially in brahmachari life, which is usually the beginning of one's spiritual life, these things are very strongly fortified. so that one's progress in Krishna consciousness throughout life will be very steady and bring one forward in Krishna consciousness. So I'll read today's verse again. It's a translation. Shukadeva Goswami said, "The son of Nabhaga was Nabhaga, or named Nabhaga, lived for a long time at the place of his spiritual master. Therefore, his brothers thought that he was not going to become a grihastha and would not return. Consequently, without providing a share for him, they divided the property of their father among themselves. When Nabhaga returned from the place of his spiritual master, they gave him their father as his share." Any questions or comments? Yes, Mother Sukada.
I was just reading that book by Renshaw, When the Sun Shines, a story about Prabhupada's pastimes in England. And there's one place where Prabhupada had come to London, and Bhajahari, I guess he was the temple president, he had gotten married while Prabhupada was gone. So the devotees had been teasing him anyway. And when he was talking to Prabhupada, Malati came and said, "Oh, you know, Prabhupada, Bhajahari got married since the last time you saw him." His face got all red, and then Srila Prabhupada said, "That is okay." He said, "One wife means brahmachari." I thought that was interesting.
Well, wait, I didn't hear what you said.
Prabhupada said what? Prabhupada said, oh, that is all right, he said. "One wife means brahmachari."
Oh, one wife, okay. Eka patni vrata, like Lord Ram. Anything else? Ramanya Prabhu?
Related to London also, Prabhupada, when he opened the temple in London, he commented, "What my god brothers and yasis cannot do it, my householders and yasis might decide."
Yeah, Prabhupada was very proud of what his
statement. Yeah.
Opened temples all over the world, lived in extremely difficult circumstances to push on his movement. So no doubt Prabhupada had great gratitude for what his Grihastha disciples were doing, certainly. Madam Mati?
Sometimes we think about the old days and we think about the austerities we performed, and we lament, I think it's good, but however, sometimes it's expressed in a very way that what we may be doing now is not good, you know. And so I was, you know, hearing your class, I was thinking that it seems like as long as we have certain basic foundations that we were brought up with, we still continue to do so. It seems like it's a natural thing. Here in Nabhaga is gone from brahmachari life, and now he's has to earn some living, and you know, it seems like a natural progression. I guess that's one of you to comment on that.
Yeah, of course, there's a whole spectrum of understanding these things and emphasis on them, and of course, people emphasize certain things. You're right, earlier in our movement, there was much more emphasis on this idea of renunciation. Of course, Rupa Goswami says renunciation means to engage everything in the service of Krishna. So that's really the principle. Our principle of renunciation is to use everything in Krishna's service. Now that being said, we do find, I've made this point before, that, you know, why didn't the Goswamis move to Vrindavan with their families? They could have kept doing their service there. Same service, they could have kept writing books. Why not? But we find that somehow that principle is still there, that sannyas is still there, and people do. And it seems to be something that's praised still today and praised by Srila Prabhupada. But as you were talking about the early days, of course, there was a lot of artificial austerity and renunciation in our early days in Krishna consciousness. And a lot of it, you might say, was forced also. We may not have always been doing it exactly willingly or in the right frame of mind, or there was a lot of fanaticism involved. And so it's a big topic, actually, with renunciation, how to apply it, and how to apply the principle. But that's the main thing. Whatever you have, use it in the service of Krishna. Just like Prabhupada didn't necessarily tell devotees who had wealth just to give it all up and just, you know, move in and be a brahmachari, but use wealth or training or anything, actually. It's not only wealth, but any talents that we have, any ability that we have. We also don't have to renounce those. We can use those in the service of Krishna. In fact, that was Prabhupada's main principle. Whatever ability you have, use it in the service of Krishna. So that's our main renunciation. But still, there's still that side of it where, like the, for example, renunciation in how much you eat. Prabhupada used to, in fact, you can hear lectures of Prabhupada talking about how we should decrease our eating and sleeping. It should be less and less and less and less until it becomes zero. Of course, he would give the example of the Goswamis. No eating, no sleeping, no mating, no defending. So, Sankhya Purvakan. So they did that by regulation. So, I mean, this is one of those kinds of things that was drilled into us when we were new devotees. You should be, year after year, you should be going less and less and less and less of these things. I remember I was going to a wedding one time. A couple got married, and one of the new ISKCON gurus was performing the ceremony, and during the wedding, he said, "Now I pronounce you man and wife," something like that. He said, "Now you have to begin renouncing." That was their wedding day. So that was a little extreme, but that was the way we used to think back then, because Prabhupada would say things like that. You have to decrease, 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 you know, the course of your life, and eventually take sannyas and give everything up. Sannyas, you give up everything for the absolute truth. So there's that side of it too, where there's real renunciation of material things, and there's renunciation by using things in Krishna's service. It seems to me that Prabhupada did actually talk about both of those kinds of renunciation. Madan Mohan Prabhu?
I was also recalling a couple times when I read this about Prabhupada had a mission to spread Krishna consciousness in preaching. And to change ashrams was seen to increase your field of preaching. So it was more not individual benefit. It was the idea that you could approach more people in a more renounced situation. So it wasn't that you wouldn't become liberated in the household of ashram.
You might say Prabhupada was sometimes creating preaching teams, but suggesting that people get married.
Because that mood and the urgency, I was once talking to a devotee not too long ago, and I said that he was saying, well, it was an emergency situation then. So it just struck me that the emergency of birth, death, disease, and old age is over now, I guess. So.
Yeah, it's always an emergency.
Madhavati?
Yeah.
Having his share, and Nabhaga means not having his share. And I was thinking, all these names have, you know, like you see Suruchi or Dhruva. All these names are according to whatever their qualities or whatever happened. I was wondering whether these names were given afterwards, or is this something that they were given at the time of birth?
Well, we do see examples that sometimes a person's name is like Prachina Barhi. He had a different name too, I think. Right, Barhishat, I think his name was Barhishat, but then he became Prachina Barhi. So that sometimes we see that there's more than one name. A person earns a name sometimes as a result of what they've done. Well, what I was thinking when I first read it, I thought, well, it's interesting that the youngest son seems to be named after the father, because usually it's the first son. You would think that the father is Nabhaga, so you'd think the first son would be Nabhaga. Because I didn't even realize what you were saying, that it means one who doesn't get his share. I assumed it just meant he was the son of Nabhaga, so his name is Nabhaga. But, well, that's interesting. One who didn't get a share, that's his name. Yeah, so that seems to happen too. So sometimes, we do have some examples we know of where people's names change as a result of something that went on during their life. All right, we'll stop here. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.